This is BraceNetRadio.com. BraceNetRadio.com.
Welcome to Vocal Point on BraceNetRadio.com. Each week, we will examine issues that concern all Christians living in today's culture. Politics, theology, world affairs, citizenship, ethics, and personal responsibility. And now, your host of Vocal Point, Jerry Newcomb on BraceNetRadio.com.
And good afternoon. Is liberalism a surrogate religion? That's what our first guest believes. And then our second guest, Julian Dobbs, will be talking about the persecution of Christians in other countries. First, I want to begin with this quote from P.J. O'Rourke. He said, at the core of liberalism is the spoiled child, miserable, as all spoiled children are, unsatisfied, demanding, ill-disciplined, despotic, and useless. Liberalism is a philosophy of sniveling brats. Well, what do you really think, P.J. O'Rourke? Now, our guest today is a fellow with the Discovery Institute, which is a wonderful organization based in Seattle. And his name is Scott Powell. We actually had him on the phone one time, but now he's live in the studio because I guess Fort Lauderdale is now his home. Is that right? All right. Great to have you here in the studio. And Scott, I understand you're an economist by trade and you went to the University of Chicago, graduated with honors, and you've been writing for Discovery Institute and thinking in their think tank for a while now. Well, that's great. And now South Florida is your home. And you wanted to come on to discuss the issue of liberalism as a surrogate religion. What do you mean by that?
Christians and Jews alike recognize that they're born with fundamental flaws, which we've referred to as original sin, and that they need help and redemption from those from that flawed state of being. The founding fathers of our nation were almost all Christians. Out of 55 delegates, 53 recognized themselves and called themselves Christian.
To the Constitution.
That's right. They drafted the Constitution of the United States in such a way that acknowledged people elected to higher office were flawed and prone to abuse of power and privilege.
Right.
And that's why they structured the Constitution with checks and balances and separation of powers. The Constitution was designed to prevent any leader or branch of government from abusing power.
James Madison, in one sentence, all men having power ought to be distrusted.
That's right. So a government of checks and balances would be limited in power and scope. In short, the founders viewed a limited government that could do relatively little as being far preferable to an activist government that would do too much and intrude and interfere with individual lives. When the Constitution was drafted, there was no notion that government would be involved in trying to eliminate poverty, provide Social Security or health care benefits, or be active in improving man's lot in life. It was to be a rule of law providing equal opportunity to all citizens. Now, it's not that the founders didn't think that these goals weren't worthy, but rather they didn't believe that government could or should try to accomplish them. I think it's safe to say the founders understood that it was the role of the church, the family, charities, and voluntarism that were better suited to mitigating a lot of problems, social problems, and advancing those goals. Now, secular progressives, to get back to your original question, also known as liberals, have a different starting point in life. While they also generally need relationships and purpose in their lives, as do Christians, as do most all people, they generally believe neither believe in God, nor do they believe that human nature is fundamentally flawed. For the liberal, the idea of original sin is a foreign concept, an anathema to his or her view that people are basically good. For the liberal, the good society is not arrived at by redeeming man from sin or improving the character of individuals. Rather, the good society is achieved by restructuring institutions. And secular progressives view the Constitution of the United States as a valid starting point, but it is basically just another institution in need of adaptation and change.
Sure. So, for example, they talk about the living Constitution, and they get it to say whatever they want it to say.
Right, right, right. So, to find meaning and purpose in life, many liberals feel compelled to be part of a cause, a progressive movement. And this progressive movement is made up of many social justice causes that effectively take the place of the personal spiritual calling of the true religious believer. This is why I call liberalism a surrogate religion. It is analogous, but not a replacement. The causes that make up the social justice movement of liberals' surrogate religious worldview are manyfold, and they would include environmentalism, feminism, civil rights of minority groups, gay rights, animal rights, multiculturalism, and, of course, global warming and climate change, to name only a few. As these causes have come to permeate the popular culture, they have come to make up what is now called a politically correct perspective mm-hmm. that pretty much dominates so much of the public debate. Mm-hmm. What religious faith also has in common with liberalism's surrogate religion is that neither is subject to empirical verification. Thus, belief in global warming lives on in spite of scientific evidence to the contrary. Feminism and multiculturalism remain unassailable in spite of the lack of evidence that either group is happier or really better off. On balance, the consequences of liberalism's surrogate religious worldview have had a largely negative impact on society as compared with the consequences of traditional religion, whose influence is inward and generally limited to the individual and family. The environment, in terms of air and water quality, for instance, is better in the United States than it was 20 years ago, 30, even 40 years ago, yet environmentalists push for ever more. And let's just take a look at the record. Environmentalists have shut down nuclear power development. They prevented oil and gas exploration on vast tracts of mineral-rich public lands. They've blocked vital energy pipelines such as the Keystone XL pipeline. And environmental regulations are closing down the coal industry and have made it all but impossible to build a new petroleum refinery, the last one being built some 38 years ago. Mm. And the need for energy in the United States is probably up 50% in those 38 years.
And meanwhile, by the way, to get this precious oil, we have to look to all these unstable governments in the Middle East and so forth. And, you know, it's like one man said, in fact, it was Robert Spencer of JihadWatch.com. He said, every time we go to the gas pump, in a sense, we're helping to fuel the war against Christians that is going on in the Middle East because, you know, so many of these things are happening. We are funding that. And it's really amazing, but apparently we have more oil in this country. However, you have to get it through fracking and some other things that are supposedly bad for the environment. Supposedly.
Well, we actually have an energy, a natural gas and oil bonanza going on right now, but it's all on private lands, and it's basically in spite of
the government
adverse public policy.
Sure.
That is driven largely by a liberal perspective.
Right. Now, first of all, let's get a few things clear here. Obviously, you're not condemning all liberals and so forth.
No.
And you also make the point, I'm sure, that maybe some of these people are very well-intentioned. But the results are catastrophic. So if you take an example of like Obamacare, the idea, in theory, maybe a few years ago, sounded good. Oh, we're going to help those who are not insured to get health insurance. And in reality, what's been happening is that, you know, a lot of us are being impacted negatively throughout the whole culture. So instead of helping the, you know, the whatever it was percentage that were not being helped, now all of us are being affected. And even that goal is not being achieved, the one to help those who are uninsured to get insurance. And young people are struggling with this. And now their job opportunities are shriveling up, and it's disastrous on every front.
It is absolutely disastrous. You know, you got to start in life by fixing what's wrong with a problem. And healthcare reform didn't even start to do that.
Right.
Essentially, we need more competition. We need to have limitations on liability. There need to be tort reform.
Well, the whole thing was designed by lawyers. You expect them to have tort reform as part of Obamacare? I mean, it didn't. So, you know, by the way, I wrote a column about Obamacare recently, and I said, I think we figured out the issue here. It's just the president mispronounced, or he confused his pronouns. It's not if you like your insurance plan, you can keep your plan. If you like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. It's if we like your insurance plan, you can keep your plan. If we like your doctor, you can keep your doctor.
And that, you know, I haven't spoken about it, but, you know, that sort of goes along with liberalism. You know, it's a rationalistic view, an elitist view, that we know what's best for everyone else. And what experience tells us, you know, throughout the history of our country, and really now as we can see in the rest of the world too, is that government does not know the answers. Oftentimes the answers are not always known at the beginning, but when you allow competition to thrive, different ideas to compete, and you go through trial and error, and oftentimes failure is the greatest teacher. When something doesn't work, you don't continue with it.
Right.
But, you know, liberalism thrives at the top with an elitist view, a rationalistic elitist view, that we know what's best for everybody.
Yeah. But, you know, we've got our work cut out for us, because number one, the elitists, they control so many of the major institutions, including academia, and that includes what is taught to our children. They also control so many of the levers of power when it comes to the government. They control much of the media, and even our children are exposed to their ideas, whether we like it or not, through either schools or through media and so forth. So we've got a lot of work to do.
That we do, but it's a very exciting time to be alive.
Well, I like that positive spin. That's very good. Now, one thing that somebody might critique you on in what you said in your opening remarks is they said, you were talking about the founding fathers and their vision for the limited government and so forth, that the liberals today would say, okay, the founding fathers were fundamentally flawed because, as they gave us the Constitution, slavery was enshrined in it in a sense, you know, by the three-fifths clause and so forth. What is your rebuttal to that?
Well, many of the founders were opposed to slavery, and compromises had to be made along the way. This was a time in our country where a government had to be established.
Mm-hmm.
And slavery was put off to a later date for many of these people. And, of course, we fought, you know, a very bloody war to end slavery.
The bloodiest.
The bloodiest war, right. So, and of course, Wilberforce in Great Britain, I don't know how many years he struggled to abolish slave trade.
50 years.
I think it was
50 years for both the slave trade first, and then the abolition of slavery throughout the British Empire.
Right, right, right.
That was the bulk of his life.
Well, if we go back to scripture, you know, we know that slavery was acknowledged as a reality of those times.
Right. We have, but there's here's an important distinction on this. Okay, the slavery that is allowed for in the Bible is what we would today call indentured servitude, the type of chattel slavery where it was as if you owned another human being, is roundly condemned, and you see that in the example of Exodus. The Egyptians oppressed the Hebrews. They enslaved them, chattel slavery, the kind we had in America, and God condemned that, and God judged the Egyptians. I believe, by the way, that the Civil War was God's judgment against the United States of America. And President Lincoln said as much in his second inaugural address. And I think he was right.
You're so right, Jerry. You're so right.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, what do you really think? No, but the reason I bring up slavery, though, is because people like Barack Obama, I mean, let's face it, he's absolutely progressive. He would definitely fit the categories of liberal that you were talking about. He would look at the founding fathers as being so fundamentally flawed. It's like, why even listen to what they have to say, because they blew it from the very beginning?
Well, anybody that reads, goes back to the primary source documents and reads, for instance, the Federalist Papers, could never say that these guys were anything short of being very profound in their thinking about the human dilemma,
yeah,
and the political dilemma.
Yeah, no, I agree.
But not all the problems were solved at the very beginning.
Right.
But the stage was set. Remember, the Constitution was put in place so that it could be amended.
Right. And, of course, it's amended every time the Supreme Court sits and has judgment, according to Gary Bauer, which actually is quite a wise point. I don't think the founders ever intended to have this judicial activism that we see happening. Do you see that as an example of liberalism run amok?
Yes, I do. Yes.
Comment on that. What is judicial activism for those not familiar?
Well, judicial activism, the judiciary should adjudicate and make decisions based on existing law. They should not create new law. And that's
right.
Why so much of our legal system is based on precedent.
Yes.
You don't make a decision that's not based on previous precedents. And judicial activism basically takes place when a particular policy or a cause or a perspective that might not be able to get legislative support through Congress, through the legislative body,
right,
then can be pushed through the courts,
sure,
through the court system and through the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Well, let me give an example. When I was doing some research years ago for the late Dr. D. James Kennedy, he was the founder, by the way, ultimately, of this particular radio station where we're sitting and broadcasting from South Florida into all the world through GraceNetRadio.com. And anyway, I went down to the main library in Fort Lauderdale years and years ago, got all these old microfiche magazine articles from the early 1960s, and saw Newsweek and U.S. News World Report, and I believe Time Magazine, with the reactions to the school prayer decisions. And it was just amazing. It was like a different country. I mean, they did not take this with a collective yawn. They were like, what? What's next? You know, in fact, I remember there was a picture showing a coin, and somebody had a chisel and hammer, and they were chiseling out, "In God We Trust," the chiseling out the word God. And this was in Time or Newsweek or U.S. News and World Report. People were totally up in arms. The vast majority of the country was very upset with this. And when you read the book The Brethren, written in the 1980s about the U.S. Supreme Court, and they were talking about some of those types of decisions, the court realized that they were on new ground, and they were essentially really legislating from the bench, which is what you're saying that the judges should not be doing according to the Founding Fathers and according to our Constitution itself.
That's correct. That's correct. The process is kind of what I would call a creeping process, where people, where the culture is transformed over time in a slow manner, so that people don't really realize how fundamentally different things are today than they were 30 or 40 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, we're talking right now with Scott Powell of Discovery Institute. Where could people see your articles and your writings and so forth?
Well, they can go right to the Discovery Institute website, and all the articles of all the fellows are available there. You could click on fellows and then choose whatever fellow you want to read. But all my articles of the last couple of years are up on that website.
Discovery.org.
That's
correct. Now, why did you zoom in on this particular issue, the idea of liberalism as a religion? And by the way, I've heard that kind of thing said before, and I've heard the phrase that, well, abortion is the ultimate sacrament within liberalism, the religion of liberalism.
Well, I think liberalism is the greatest challenge, to our culture and to our public policy today. And if people don't understand its roots and what it is, it's hard for them to be able to speak, truth to power.
Yeah.
The liberals have the power more than Christians do today. Our power is in the private, sort of in the private sphere, but, we've been sort of pushed out of the public space.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as John Newhouse called it, the naked public square.
Right. Richard John Newhouse, founder of the magazine First Things.
Correct.
And, okay, so let me ask you a question. What about within even the churches themselves? Do you find that in some ways there's some forms of political correctness infecting the churches?
Perhaps? Oh, that has been going on for a long, long time. I mean, the communists made it their target to get involved and get into influential positions in the mainline churches.
Mm-hmm.
And they carried that out in the 1930s and 40s. And that sort of influence that, liberalism is really a kissing cousin to, to socialism and communism.
Yeah.
And that influence remains today in the mainline Protestant churches, in the National Council of Churches and the World Council of Churches. But the reaction is that there's a, you know, a growth of evangelism throughout the United States and the world.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting that I remember years ago, Time Magazine and I think 60 Minutes even did a report where they found that people in the mainline denominations, this is going back many years ago, in the 80s at least, people in the mainline denominations were making donations for missions overseas in Africa. And those missions funds were then going in to actually fund some of the communist movements in some of those countries. And then those communists on the ground with guns and, you know, weapons and so forth were killing Christian missionaries. And as that report came out and was documented and so forth and brought to light in both 60 Minutes and Reader's Digest, people were shocked that this kind of thing could happen. Oh, I'm not saying it happens today, but maybe it's more subtle today.
Oh, I think there's a lot of misallocation of resources at, you know, at every level. I mean, the United Nations is, you know, has a lot of corruption, and we know what's happened there with various programs, how they've been misdirected, how funds have been fundamentally misused and misdirected.
So, how do we start to change any of this? I mean, the Lord has raised us up for such a time as this. What are we supposed to do? How then shall we live?
Well, we show a good example and we speak truth to power wherever we can. I mean, I think that there, you know, there's a huge need. As I said at the outset, people are looking for purpose and meaning in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And the surrogate religion of liberalism has occupied that space for many people, but the reality is that, as you described it through your quotation of P.J. O'Rourke, liberals are generally not happy people. You know, they are forever frustrated. They are forever at odds with the society in which they live. And I think, frankly, that many liberals can be reached by speaking truth to power, but you have to find the right time, and you have to know how to finesse those things.
But now, this phrase, speaking truth to power, I hear that spouted off so often by liberals that it just sort of is meaningless to me. But what do you mean? You're sort of incorporating it for yourself, for the conservative side of things.
Well, I write and speak on economic matters.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, economics is a fascinating science, because it starts with a perspective that no one knows the answers. It's kind of a humble posture in life. You know, we may see the problems out there, and we want to solve those problems, but we don't always know at the outset how we're going to solve those problems. You know, Edison had the vision of a illumination, a light bulb, right?
Right.
And I don't know how many experiments.
More than 10,000.
Yeah, he had to go through,
yep,
in order to find the right formula.
And I don't know if this story is true, but apparently after about 9,000 times, 9,000 elements that he tried, somebody said, hey, you failed so many times, aren't you just going to give it up? And he said, no, I haven't failed 9,000 times. I have found 9,000 elements that don't work. I'm going to keep digging until I find one that does. And he did. And we're in light in this studio.
That's right.
And I've traveled in India, and I've seen lights all over there, you know, and I thought, hey, that was invented in my country. Not that I mean to be proud there, but all right, Scott Powell is our guest. We have about 7 minutes remaining. What do you want to say? Where does Jesus Christ fit into all this?
Well, he is, you know, he is the beginning and the end. I mean, he is the starting point and the ending point. You know, we can be freed from our, you know, from what holds us back, our problems, the issues of our past. He offers that promise to free us and allow us to go forward in our lives unencumbered. And an unencumbered life is truly a great life.
But isn't it also true that he is the source of life, and to him we shall all give an account?
That's right. Absolutely.
There's strong implications for that.
That, you know, so an unencumbered life, a life of freedom, is not a life without responsibility. There is no freedom without responsibility. Hmm. And so we have to find our place. You know, we have to use our talents in such a way that, you know, we're making a contribution to helping other people, to improving life. And sometimes that's very simple and humble work. I mean, where would we all be if we didn't have all the people providing these simple services of our lives, whether it's, you know, at the service stations, or it's your lawn maintenance people.
And they're not doing it necessarily out of the goodness of their hearts. They're doing it because this is a way in which they can make an honest living.
That's right.
And so in so serving, if you want to, you know, increase your reward, then increase your service, I guess, in a sense.
Yes.
Elaborate on it.
Well, you know, when people do a good job, typically they are recognized. And they find that when they do a good job, they find satisfaction. I mean, when we think of healthcare reform, it's not government mandates that are going to make doctors perform better. It is their entrepreneurial disposition of wanting to find the right solution for the patient that compels them to do good things. And getting back to your question of what we could do as a nation, I'll go back to the founding fathers. They created a federal system that empowered the states. You know, we have 50 states that could each be places of experimentation on healthcare, and let the best solution win out, instead of a nationalized program of a failed system. Imposing a failed system on all 50 states is really a tragedy.
You know, it's funny you bring this up, because there was a recent report comparing the different states, and the question was, where do you have to wait for a doctor the longest in the United States? Which state? You know what the answer is?
I don't.
Massachusetts. And Massachusetts was a forerunner to Obamacare, in a sense. You know, the idea of, oh, we'll have state-run health care in Massachusetts, and that's where you have to wait for the longest for a doctor. Something like 82 days, you know, on average, that kind of thing.
Well, you know, what's amazing is that American people are all very accustomed to the power of competition. I mean, we see it in the retail world with Amazon and Walmart. We see it in the sports industry where...
We're spoiled in that respect.
Absolutely.
As far as this competition, you know, it's true.
We see it in communication. We see it in almost every industry. Why can't we embrace it in the healthcare industry? Allow competition to work. In other words, we want to create a system that encourages and fosters and protects competition, because, number one, it will produce a higher quality product at a lower price.
Yeah.
It works.
Right. Very good. All right, Scott, thank you for being with us. How about a closing thought in terms of liberalism as a surrogate religion?
Well, I think I would never, you know, want to disparage people's character or suggest that they're misguided. People have to discover the truth for themselves, and oftentimes, you know, the truth is apparent all around them if they'll only look.
All right, very good. Again, people could see Scott's work at discovery.org. Scott Powell, hey, thank you so much for being with us. And when we come back on Vocal Point, we'll be talking with Bishop Julian Dobbs of the, what is it called? We'll explain what he does. But he travels a lot in the world and is very... knowledgeable about what's going on to the Christians in many other countries, and it's a very disturbing picture, especially in Syria, Iraq, Nigeria, Egypt, and other hotspots. Again, Scott, thanks for being with us. God bless.